It's prairie chicken mating season. It's tough being a lesser prairie chicken these days. This type of grouse once spanned an enormous area. Now they survive mainly in pockets of Oklahoma and Kansas, and their numbers are plummeting. The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service recently listed the bird as a threatened species, and that's led to complaints of federal government overreach and to lawsuits. Frank Morris of member station KCUR reports.
The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service had been threatening to step in and protect the lesser prairie chicken for years, a sour prospect for farmers and ranchers who own almost all the bird's habitat.
They almost think they can take over your property if you're not doing everything you can to make sure this species survives.
Norval Ralston has thousands of acres with crops, cattle, and wind turbines near Mullenville, Kansas. The wind power and oil companies that operate out here don't want the feds coming in either. So over the last few years, they worked with Fish and Wildlife to come up with a grand plan.
We just call it the range-wide plan.
Jim Pittman with the Kansas Department of Wildlife, Parks, and Tourism says it covers the bird's entire habitat, parts of Colorado, New Mexico, Texas, Oklahoma, and Kansas.
It's unprecedented. It's really difficult for state agencies to work across those political boundaries.
The plan will pay landowners to make their property more livable for prairie chickens. Companies that degrade habitat will have to compensate landowners to create more of it elsewhere. It could be profitable for farmers and ranchers, and it needs to be. U.S. Fish and Wildlife Director Daniel Ash says the birds are desperate for habitat.
They've lost 84% of the short grass prairie, which this bird depends on as its home.
We're walking towards a lek, which is kind of like a singles bar for prairie chickens. They get together and do their thing. Half a dozen football-shaped males with striped plumage and bulging orange air sacs on their necks are strutting around this patch of high ground, picking fights and trying to impress the ladies.
Hen just flew in.
Ken Brunson with the Nature Conservancy says the birds convene at the same spots each year to mate, but otherwise keep their distance.
This is a large landscape species. The birds from this lek will probably require up to 20 square miles for their home range to be able to exist.
They only nest on the ground and nowhere near a tree or anything else like an oil derrick or wind turbine sticking up from the prairie. There were once millions of the birds, and Daniel Ash says now there may be fewer than 18,000.
We've made a threatened determination, which allows us flexibility to acknowledge the work that's been done at the state level.
That range-wide plan we talked about. Ash says this special listing only improves the regionally created plan. Oklahoma Attorney General Scott Pruitt is not buying it.
For the Fish and Wildlife Service to come out and say, yes, we're going to classify the lesser prairie chicken as a threatened species, but we're not going to change anything, seems to beg the question, then why did you take the step?
Pruitt plans to sue to stop the listing, but the real action is with the landowners. If they don't agree to take payments to manage their properties in bird-friendly ways, the whole range-wide plan falls apart.
I'm not a federal government man.
Wayne Keller is scanning the vast expanse of caramel-colored prairie from his ranch south of Dodge City for prairie chickens. The birds' numbers dropped by half in 2012 alone. Keller says it's drought that's killing them.
Really, 4 years are just real brutal conditions. No morning dews, just blast furnace winds.
The prairie grass has died back, and the wildlife depending on it is suffering. Lesser prairie chickens only live about a year and a half average, so a couple of years without chicks takes a serious toll. Back at the breeding ground, these blustery males are doing their part. If they can get the hens and the weather to cooperate, each couple could produce up to a dozen chicks and help build the birds' numbers. But with lawsuits, legislation, and hard feelings to sort out, repairing its habitat and its long-term prospects is going to be a lot more difficult. For NPR News, I'm Frank Morris.
Stay with us for more All Things Considered from NPR News.
Yesterday on the program, we heard about the oil boom in South Texas along the Eagle Ford Shale. The drilling and fracking have brought an influx of industry and cash to formerly impoverished communities.
It's progress. It has provided opportunity beyond belief, beyond what anybody could have imagined.
But there's a serious environmental and health toll as well, according to an investigative team that looked into pollution from the boom. The reporters decided to focus not on water pollution, but on what they consider an equally serious problem that gets less attention, air pollution. Jim Morris is senior investigative reporter with the Center for Public Integrity, and he led the 8-month investigation, along with Inside Climate News and the Weather Channel. Morris describes the emissions as a toxic soup of chemicals being released into the air day in and day out along the Eagle Ford Shale.
It's a combination of what's called volatile organic compounds, and that's carcinogens like benzene would be an example. Formaldehyde would be another. There's a long list of these chemicals. On top of that, you've got sulfur dioxide, which is a component of smog. It's a respiratory irritant, so people who already have or are prone to asthma, for example, they're exposed to sulfur dioxide. It gets immeasurably worse.
And when you think about the health effects of these emissions, let's listen to voices of three people who live in the heart of the Eagle Ford Shale. They're from Karnes County. These are people you interviewed for a video report that you produced with the Weather Channel and Inside Climate News.
For myself, I've experienced a lot of difficulty with my breathing.
I used to come out here, this very park before, and run literally about 4 or 5 miles a day without any problems. Now I barely get a mile out before I start choking. It's just something heavier with the air.
I have 2.5 acres and I can't bring my grandchild out here to enjoy it because I'm afraid for his health.
Jim Morris, how common were these complaints and is there medical evidence to back up what they're saying?
The complaints we heard were very common. We reviewed about 300 complaints that had been filed by citizens of the Eagle Ford with the Texas Commission on Environmental Quality. And just saw a lot of common threads, headaches, nausea, breathing difficulties, nosebleeds. And when you look at the science on some of the chemicals that are coming out of these operations, you see those are the very symptoms that would be expected to be associated with emissions from the oil and gas industry.
Let's talk about the Texas Commission on Environmental Quality, TCEQ, which is in charge of monitoring most air emissions. What's their track record?
The TCEQ's track record is not good, either in terms of monitoring for toxics in the air. They've only got 5 permanent monitors in the entire Eagle Ford Shale, which is 20,000 square miles, twice the size of the state of Massachusetts.
And by monitor, you mean an actual physical station?
Physical station. We saw one in Floresville, Texas, which is on the sort of northern fringe of the shale play. And the other 4 are down on the border around Laredo. And so they don't have these permanent monitors in places where there's heavy drilling. So their record is not good in that regard. TCEQ's record on enforcement is not good either. We looked at nearly 300 complaints that have been filed by residents of the Eagle Ford, and there were 164 violations that were documented by the TCEQ as a result of those complaints. So they did find problems. But then we found that out of those 164 violations, there were only 2 fines levied, the biggest of which was about $14,000. So it's not much of a stretch to see why companies don't really take that agency very seriously.
When you confronted folks from the oil industry with your reporting and said, look, we're hearing all these complaints about health effects from air pollution, emissions from oil production facilities, what did they say? What's the response from the oil industry to this?
Well, the first problem we had was getting somebody to respond. We had a heck of a time when we were in Texas, and between us and Inside Climate News and the Weather Channel, we made, I want to say, 8 separate trips down there. So there were plenty of opportunities to do on the ground, face-to-face, in some cases on-camera interviews with representatives of some of the big oil companies in the Eagle Ford, like Marathon Oil, for example, or ConocoPhillips. And they all declined. They didn't want to talk to us. A couple of them answered questions in writing. We did do an interview with a gentleman here in Washington named Steve Everly, who's with a group called Energy in Depth. And his response was, there's no evidence that these emissions are causing any harm. The problem is a lot of the concern associated with chemicals like benzene you know, if it's a carcinogen, you're not going to see the problem right away. You're going to see it 10, 20, 30 years down the road.
There is one other aspect to this in your reporting, which is no surprise, the oil and gas industry, especially in Texas, is immensely politically powerful.
I think what surprised us is that it's even more powerful than we realized. We did an analysis as part of our reporting and found legislators or their spouses had direct financial interests in the Eagle Ford. In other words, either got royalties from or held stock in companies that were actively drilling in the Eagle Ford Shale.
Why doesn't the Federal Environmental Protection Agency step in? If there are concerns that the state isn't doing its job in Texas on monitoring air pollution, what about the EPA?
That is a very good question, and it's one that we're going to be asking in some of our follow-up stories. I mean, the states are responsible for enforcing the Federal Clean Air Act with the EPA as a supposed backstop. But there's really no evidence that the EPA has stepped in Texas or will step in. And so that's a question we're going to be asking, I hope, of the regional EPA administrator in the very near future.
Jim Morris, thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
Jim Morris with the Center for Public Integrity. He led an 8-month investigation looking into air pollution from the Eagle Ford Shale. In Beijing last month, a piece of art sold at auction for $860. That doesn't sound like a lot until you hear this piece of art is a jar filled with air, ostensibly clean air captured in Provence in France. It's one of the latest examples of artistic protests against China's horrible air pollution. Reporter Didi Tong has been writing about this for the Associated Press, and she joins me now from Beijing. And Didi, talk just a bit more about this pollution protest art and the artist behind it.
So the artist who created it, and his name is Liang Kegang, and he is an artist in Beijing. And he told me that when I was in province, I just was amazed at how clean the air is. And that's actually what resonates with most people living in Beijing. Even for me, I have been living here for 2 years. But last year, when I went back to the States, when I saw the clean air, and when I saw the blue sky, I was just amazed. So he decided, he said, you know, that kind of idea came to him. He was going to capture a jar of air and brought to Beijing as a conceptual art, as a way to tell people, look, the air here is really, really bad, and as his way to protest the dirty air in Beijing.
And that's all it is. It's just a jar with air inside it and some labels on it saying where it's theoretically from.
Yes, yes. I did ask him to show me how did he create that art. And he told me that he went to this little town and he opened up the jar and then let it, you know, stay open for a few seconds and closed it. And that was it. That was the whole production of this piece of art.
And he managed to find a buyer.
Yes, yes. And he was kind of curious. He was thinking, hey, how much would this jar of, you know, air will go for? So he did not really put up for a public auction, but he actually listed in a very small circle of artists and collectors throughout China. And he told me that he had no expectations as far as the price would go. And then finally, someone from Chengdu, another city in southwest China, which also has had pretty bad air throughout, you know, the last year. And then some artist and collector over there in Chengdu, and he bought it.
You know, it sounds like this is part of a wave of various kinds of artistic protest against air pollution and environmental problems in general in China.
Yes, yes. The most common ways we have seen oftentimes is related to death. You know, we had this case in February when probably a dozen artists in Beijing, they played dead in a Beijing park as their way to protest the smog. And then another case was a funeral, you know, kind of funeral burying people dying of smog in the city of Changsha, and that's in southern China.
A mock funeral.
Yeah, a mock funeral. So when I was talking to Liang Kegang, and he did tell me, he said, you know, artists, you know, they have those social responsibilities, they wanted to say something about it, but then he has found, you know, their expressions to be a little bit on the darker side. And he told me that he was thinking about a lighter way to protest. And that idea of selling, you know, having a jar of clean air, that came to him when he was in province last month.
You know, we're talking about some
fairly lighthearted treatments of what is a really serious, deadly issue there in China. At its worst point in Beijing, how bad has the air been?
On days when the air was really bad, you could smell it. It was kind of like you were in a smoking room, probably with hundreds of smokers. Probably I'm exaggerating a little bit there. But, you know, the visibility would cut down to probably 10 meters or about 10 yards or so. You cannot see the buildings outside your own windows.
Didi Tang, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, Melissa.
That's AP correspondent Didi Tang in Beijing. We were talking about artists protesting China's bad air pollution. The latest example, a jar that was labeled as containing clean French air that sold for $860.
The world still has time to take action and reduce the effects of climate change, but time is running out. This is according to the latest report from an expert panel convened by the United Nations. The panel says that greenhouse gas emissions will need to drop dramatically in the coming decades, and they lay out the options for doing that. NPR's Nell Greenfield-Boyce has more.
Hundreds of experts from dozens of countries worked on this new report from the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. Otmar Edenhofer is a German economist who co-chaired the group that wrote it. He says scientists and government delegates had an intense meeting in Berlin to hammer out the language. At one point, he was negotiating for 28 hours nonstop.
So I have two espressos in the morning, two espressos in the afternoon, two espressos overnight, and two more Cokes.
The result of all that caffeinated negotiation is a document called Climate Change 2014, Mitigation of Climate Change. It points out that emissions of greenhouse gases grew more quickly between 2000 and 2010 than in each of the previous three decades.
Emissions keep rising and we risk for the second half of the century unabated climate change. And there is an increasing awareness around the globe that unabated climate change poses a huge risk.
Because of that risk, there's an international target to keeping the global temperature rise to just 2 degrees Celsius. That's 3.6 degrees Fahrenheit.
We are not saying that it is easy to achieve this. We say under very specific circumstances, we can do this.
Edenhofer says the report shows that it's still technically possible to limit the warming to 2 degrees Celsius, but greenhouse gas emissions would have to drop 40 to 70% by 2050, and then drop even more to nearly zero by the end of this century. Doing that would mean a huge shift towards energy sources like wind, solar, or nuclear power, plus a slew of other changes like increasing the energy efficiency of buildings and slowing deforestation.
That's not going to happen on its own. Public policies are going to be required. That's the key message.
Robert Stavins of Harvard University is an economist and expert on climate agreements who worked on the report. He says one issue raised in the report is the idea of geoengineering, using new technologies to suck carbon dioxide from the atmosphere.
It's quite controversial. It's controversial among environmental advocates, it's controversial among scientists, and it's certainly controversial among governments. But research is clearly needed.
A central theme of this report is that timing is critical. Jennifer Morgan is director of the Climate and Energy Programs at the World Resources Institute in Washington, D.C. She was a reviewer for one of the report's chapters.
What this report means is that there are very key choices for governments and business and citizens to make, and that if we wait, we will close off opportunities to avoid the impacts and will make it a lot more expensive.
She says the international community is getting ready to negotiate a new climate change agreement next year under the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change.
Every country in the world by the first quarter of 2015 has to put an offer on the table to the rest of the world about what they're going to do to tackle the problem.
Morgan says this report gives them all the tools they'll need to do that. Nell Greenfield-Boyce, NPR News.
In Louisiana, a high-stakes political battle is playing out over whether the oil and gas industry should pay for decades of wetlands destruction and coastal erosion. A flood protection authority is suing nearly 100 oil, gas, and pipeline companies, arguing their activities make New Orleans even more vulnerable to floods. Their main concern? The dredging of thousands of miles of canals through coastal lands to make way for pipelines. Louisiana Governor Bobby Jindal and top legislators legislators are trying to stop the lawsuit, saying it's bad for business. NPR's Debbie Elliott reports.
Louisiana's coast is disappearing at the rate of about a football field an hour. Since the 1930s, the Gulf of Mexico has swallowed up an area the size of Delaware. You can see the water encroaching in St. Bernard Parish, less than an hour southeast of New Orleans.
Well, we're here in Delacroix, right across this waterway. Used to be land behind that line of brush, and now it's water.
Historian John Barry stands on a narrow crescent of land known locally as the end of the world. The road to Delacroix comes to an abrupt dead end at Bayou Terre Boeufs. In the distance, you can see the tops of now submerged trees where oaks and sycamores once covered the landscape.
It's hard to imagine if the coast continues to erode and enormous amounts of money are not invested in protecting it, that New Orleans could survive.
Barry is known for his book Rising Tide about the 1927 Mississippi River flood. Most recently, he was vice president of the Southeast Louisiana Flood Protection Authority East and pushed the lawsuit alleging that oil and gas companies destroyed land that once served as a buffer protecting New Orleans from hurricanes.
The loss of this land has increased the storm surge on the Flood Protection Authority's property, the levees, and made our burden much greater.
The authority is responsible for maintaining an elaborate new levee system built after Hurricane Katrina, an endeavor expected to cost about $40 million a year. And it's not the only one looking for energy companies to pay up. Two Louisiana parishes are also suing for coastal restoration. The litigious environment discourages business investment, says Gifford Briggs, vice president of the Louisiana Oil and Gas Association.
That's sending a message to the oil and gas industry that if you want to operate in Louisiana, you have to be prepared to be sued.
He rejects claims that companies are to blame for about a third of Louisiana's land loss because of the canals they cut through the wetlands.
In the 60s and 70s, when we were doing exploration in coastal Louisiana, we had to create canals. So from a standpoint of land loss, it's clear that when you dig a canal or create a canal that there's land loss. But being responsible for the coastal erosion side of it, you know, that's not something that we feel like we're responsible for.
Briggs says the reason Louisiana has a coastal land crisis is not oil and gas activity, but the way the Mississippi River has been controlled by the federal government. Flood protection systems prevent sediment from flowing downstream to replenish the delta.
Trying to blame us for something that is really the responsible Army Corps of Engineers is nothing more than just a money grab.
Somebody should pay, says Stephen Estopinal, current vice president of the New Orleans Flood Protection Authority. He says the courtroom is the logical place to decide who should pay what.
You bring them in the court and let's have the courts decide. That is the very conservative thing to do. The liberal thing to do would be to have Uncle Sam come in and make it all better.
Estopinal is a surveyor and civil engineer from St. Bernard Parish and has measured firsthand the disappearing coast. Estopinal says he's not out to cast oil companies as the lone villain.
I don't want the oil and gas industry to take the whole bullet because they're a very important industry. I like gas in my car. I also like to have a home to go back to. We're not talking about inconvenience. We're not talking about the little birdies or how nice things looked before and how bad they look now. We're talking about survival.
The prospect of a legal fight has sparked an epic political battle in Baton Rouge. Governor Bobby Jindal and Republican legislative leaders are pushing bills to retroactively quash the lawsuits. Oil and gas severance taxes make up about 10% of the state's general fund budget. State Transportation Chairman Robert Adley worked most of his career in the oil and gas business. He says it's bad policy to target a key industry that had permission from the state to develop its natural resources.
I don't believe that anyone ought to be sued or exploited for doing what they were told to do. Now, it's easy to argue about the big bad oil companies and that kind of thing, but the truth of the matter is we as a people, we want what they have.
Proponents of the lawsuit say it's the other way around.
Oil companies can't leave Louisiana. We've got what they want.
Democrat Foster Campbell is a public service commissioner.
Here we have in Louisiana for years and years and years kowtowed to the oil companies under these threat that we will leave Louisiana. They're not leaving Louisiana. We're where the oil is. We're where the gas is. We're where the delivery system is for America.
and America needs what Louisiana has. The question is just who should pay to keep Louisiana intact. Debbie Elliott, NPR News.
There's a very old cherry tree in Japan. It's said to be about 1,250 years old. And in 2008, a few hundred of this tree's seeds took a ride up to the International Space Station.
And they flew these seeds for 8 months on space. And then they brought these seeds home and planted them in 14 different locations across Japan.
That's Marshall Porterfield. He's the Division Director for Space Life and Physical Sciences at NASA. He spent years investigating the effects of plants growing in space. But something happened to these pits that even he can't explain.
A few of these trees that were flown in space, they bloomed 6 years ahead of time.
Normally, it takes 10 years for cherry trees to start producing any buds. But several of the trees from the seeds that went into space have blossomed after only four. And Marshall Porterfield says that's a surprise.
The U.S. has conducted seeds in space programs in the past on shuttle, and they also had tomato seeds in space for several years on a satellite that was deployed from shuttle called the Long Duration Exposure Facility. Those experiments did not present results that were as dramatic as what the Japanese are reporting now with the cherry trees.
The space cherry tree wasn't part of a formal experiment, so no one knows why this happened. But Porterfield has his own theories.
It could be that the stress associated with the time that the plants were in space and the amount of time that the seeds were stored could have led to this kind of response.
Porterfield says future experiments on plant growth in space are in the works. We can only hope that they can shed light on the mystery of these early blooming space cherry trees.